Studios at Universal Orlando Resort.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Smart Clock Podcast is back once again.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Finally, The Rock has come back to Washington, D.C.
Welcome to WCW Monday Nitro. We're on the air for three.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to our nostalgic podcast of the week. That podcast that helps you get through your Mondays. And of course, we are referring to Manic Mondays. Ladies and gentlemen, I am your host, Amiro Zanetti. And joining me as ever is the creator of the concept and my regular co-host from part one of Week in the Universe, Steve Neal.
Hello, mate. How are we doing this week? We've got an awesome Manic Mondays lined up that the fans have voted for. We've got a tribute, of course, to the late, great Bobby the Brain Heenan, who we lost tragically last week. His battle with cancer finally ended and Bobby moved up. So we wanted to kind of have a little bit of a tribute and a look back at the memories of Bobby and also the influence and lasting impact that he's had on the business, his indelible mark on professional wrestling. And also we're going to talk about Royal Rumble 2001, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Royal Rumble match of all time. Certainly my personal favourite and an epic choice by you and the fans. And of course, we'll be smashing out our traditional mid-carder of the week and match of the week apiece to close out the show. So, should we get into, I guess, the heavy stuff first and move into a little bit of the legend that is Bobby the Brain?
Let's remember one of the greatest ever to play the game, so to speak. So, Bobby the Brain Heenan, born, of course, Raymond Louis Heenan, but in Chicago, Illinois. No doubt Chi-Town is the perfect place for a man of this level of charisma and character to come out of. A man who never, ever had a filter. Never ever pulled any punches in an era when, let's be honest, a lot of what WWF was offering was comic book, cookie cutter, and frankly, insulting to the audience. This man was the pivot, really. He was the guy that sat there and made sure there was the right balance. He was Jerry Lawler on commentary before there was a Jerry Lawler. He was the ultimate heel, and not to mention a great in-ring personality. And frankly, along with Paul Heyman, one of the greatest managers of all time. I don't think people truly appreciate how great a manager he was. And that was something I wanted to focus on, because a lot of my memories of Bobby the Brain Heenan are of him fumbling around the ring like a buffoon, like an obnoxious, disgraceful, abusive attorney, frankly. And the way he would charge around the ring, he was the manager to, frankly, anyone who mattered in that era, especially in the mid to late 80s and the early 90s. He was a pivotal part of WrestleMania. In the early inception, he added emphasis, character, and charisma to people like Andre the Giant, for instance, somebody who looked fantastic, whose presence alone was that of a star. But the problem was that Andre the Giant, like so many other men of that kind of ilk, didn't create that kind of personality and charisma through his personality, his out-of-ring personality, his in-ring personality even. And that's where Bobby the Brain Heenan is so important, very much like, I almost kind of like the comparisons, which I don't hear often, to Paul Heyman. I consider Bobby the Brain Heenan to be like an original Paul Heyman. I feel like everything that you see from Heyman, who is, you know, arguably the greatest mic worker in terms of management ever, I think a lot of what he does is influenced and directly related to the nature of Bobby the Brain Heenan's mentality. But what makes Bobby the Brain Heenan so cool is the fact that he's just so unique. despite the fact that someone like a Heyman or anyone else in the magic, oh, there's a Truth Martini as a guy who works in Ring of Honor who displays some sort of characteristics from that person, but none of them look or even feel like Bobby the Brain Heenan. He is, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the most unique personas I've ever seen. Nobody comes close to even being a tribute or a copy of him or even a cheap imitation. He is so standalone in his Hall of Fame credentials. And when I think about him, I think about the brutality and the honesty of his nature, not just as a persona, but also in shoot interviews. One of my most abiding memories of Bobby Heenan was when he was asked to speak about Ultimate Warrior during a independent shoot documentary that was filmed at his house. And this guy asked him, what do you think of the Ultimate Warrior? And this was at a time where Ultimate Warrior was still essentially blacklisted from WWE as it was then. And it, you know, it had transitioned at that point. And he was asked what he thought. And he got the tape recorder, which was being used to record this interview. And he went into the bathroom and he held it by the toilet and he flushed the toilet. And he handed it back to him. He said, that's what I think of the Ultimate Warrior. Because to Bobby the Brain Heenan, the fact that someone like the Ultimate Warrior felt that he was above the product, that he could ransom Vince McMahon, who, frankly, Bobby the Brain Heenan at so many times actually had no love lost for in himself. The fact that he was so protective of the business that had given him his entire life, he was willing to throw a man under the bus in such brutal fashion. And that was his MO. He was so real, so raw, so honest. The way he would tear people to pieces as you probably saw the tribute package with him, and you might have noticed the Bobby the Brain Heenan show. In the late 80s and early 90s, WWF, like I mentioned, was just comic book. It was stupid. You have, dumb shit. Like, Doink the Clown was a legend, but obviously the character's a bit dumb. You had the gobbledygooker, the goon, all this kind of stuff. And Bobby the Brain Heenan had his little show, and he actually had a porn star on at one point. You know, he would have these obnoxious drag queens, these hot buttons, these topics that people didn't want to discuss. That was a time when things like that were unacceptable. You know, you couldn't be edgy. You couldn't be dangerous. Bobby the Brain Heenan is the first guy to do that in wrestling. He's the first guy to tip the scales and tip the boundaries with an entertainment aspect, because we'd always had chain matches, leather strap matches. We'd had blood. We'd had hardcore rivalries from the territories, but we'd never had big on-screen representation of celebrities with taboo subjects like that, with things like drag queens, like strippers, like porn stars. The fact that he would say such obnoxiously rude things to people. People look back. I imagine at the time people were like, oh, he's just disgusting. You know, his behavior is unacceptable. But the reality is he was a trendsetter, because when you see all this shoot stuff now, particularly on Raw, when we're looking at John Cena and Roman Reigns and their behavior right now, and the fact that they're, shooting on each other, one's calling one a fake ass bitch, stuff like that. Bobby Brain Heenan was doing that 30 years ago. He was doing this stuff that nobody else had ever done before. You know, it's just like breaking the fourth wall, but still being kayfabe, which is so unique, because Roman Reigns and John Cena, frankly, don't have the talent to do that like he did. They simply don't. As big as stars they are, especially John Cena, they don't even hold a candle to the abilities this man had. And my abiding memories of him, along with all this history, is his relationship with Tony Schiavone, not his relationship with Gorilla Monsoon. The stuff with Gorilla Monsoon is well told. Everybody knows that stuff. They can see that for themselves. It's iconic, and frankly, I don't need to retell any of those stories to you, because you will all know that, and you will all celebrate his life by seeing a lot of that stuff yourselves. The stuff with Tony Schiavone is interesting because people remember WCW as a dumpster fire, a car crash, essentially, other than a couple of years of greatness. And I look back at everything that Bobby the Brain Heenan did for WCW and his vitriol and his disgust for someone like Tony Schiavone. And even when he you know, when WCW went out of business, Bobby DeBrain Heenan essentially just kind of drifted off and became, you know, a more of an independent shoot guy. You know, just, you know, the regular appearances that you get from these older guys as they slip into semi-retirement. Still held such disdain for Tony Schiavone. But the way they played it out on screen was always so fascinating. The fact that he would sit there as this weasel. You know, weasel is what he's renowned as. And when you think of the word weasel, it comes with connotations of negativity, misery, disgust, snitch, rat, that kind of stuff, you know. And he created a persona with the word weasel and made it iconic. Things like weasel, rat, snitch, grass, those are all comments of disdain. They're not supposed to be iconic. They're not supposed to come with a catch line or a great sense of achievement. And he somehow was able to turn all of that into a great sense of achievement. When I see so many wrestlers now, especially in the WWE product, are shooting on each other. Like I mentioned, Reigns and Cena. You got the Neville and Enzo Amore dynamic. You got the Miz, Kevin Owens. These guys are all doing a relatively good job, except for Enzo Amore, who's a piece of shit. And yet, none of them hold a candle to the abilities and the joy and the silver-tongued serpentry that he would bring on the microphone. I cannot express just how divisive and yet so awe-inspiring it is to listen to a man with zero filter. And it's quite funny, actually, because Steve's probably going to be taken aback by this a little bit. But obviously, I've known Steve 12 years. And I almost see his attitude and his style and approach to life in a similar sense of Bobby DeBrain Heenan. You're ferociously honest, ferociously raw.
Beautiful.
And you are happy to, at any point, put people in their place, whether it be at the expense of emotion or not. And it's actually quite admirable in this day and age where people are tiptoeing around and trying not to offend each other. And Bobby DeBrain Heenan is, for me, the greatest example of that mentality. If you know, you hear people say, I tell it how it is. I'm blunt, I'm honest, I'm real. Well, he is the epitome of that in every sense. And that, for me, I can't give him any more of a glowing representation, but to say that for me, he is the very definition of what it is to be real, to be true to the character that you are, to be that man who is the volume turned up to 11. That kind of strategy that made so many stars, The Rock, Stone Cold Steve Austin, Kurt Angle, everybody that you see who has been of relative success, it's their persona turned up to 11. Bobby DeBrain Heenan, for my money, is the very first person to truly personify that. And he is the personification of real. He is, without a shadow of a doubt, the greatest wordsmith that I have ever seen and heard in the WWE and in wrestling, full stop. Never mind sports entertainment. He is, without a shadow of a doubt, the realest guy in the room, so to speak. You know, I hear someone like Enzo Amore talking about being real. I wish Bobby DeBrain Heenan was here now just to walk up to Enzo Amore and tell him what he is, because he would have the man sitting in a fetal position crying his eyes out. He is so real, so raw. He was so real, so raw. And for that, he will be sorely missed in a world full of PC bullshit. To cap it off, rest well, rest easy, and know that your legacy will be eternal.
Yes, beautiful, really. And for me, I think with Bobby Heenan, it's, I mean, you've mentioned a couple of names there. Paul Heyman, Jerry the King Lawler. The fact that he was the precursor to those guys. And I actually posted a video on Twitter the other day of a promo that manager Bobby Heenan is cutting on Hulk Hogan, the big face of the company at the time during the 80s, where he's saying, I just want to destroy you and your legacy. I don't care about anything else. That's what I'm driven to do in life. I will find a superstar who will accomplish that. I don't care if you end up homeless. I don't care if you end up eating out of trash cans. It's an incredible goosebump-raising promo. And you know that Paul Heyman has sat and watched that 1,000 times and is trying to channel that. In addition, Jerry the King Lawler. Now, as much as we can have our doubts about Jerry the King as a human being, Hang on. Really?
Sorry.
As much as we can have our doubts about Jerry the King Lawler as a human being in a lot of ways, and obviously he became somewhat out of touch with society as a whole as his career wound down, there is no doubt that he was a great heel commentator, and he was one of the iconic voices of professional wrestling during the Attitude Era, during the greatest, most successful and prosperous era in wrestling history. Bobby Heenan actually introduced Jerry Lawler to the to WWF television as a commentator alongside Vince McMahon. Jerry Lawler spent his entire career trying to be what Bobby Heenan had already been for years. And that was a phenomenal heel commentator. Bobby Heenan almost created that role, created that niche. No one had really done it before. And his ability to play off anyone who sat alongside him. And for me, Jerry Lawler didn't have that. As you know, great as Jerry Lawler was in his day, he didn't have that same ability to have repartee, whether he was sitting alongside Michael Cole or JBL or Michael Hayes or whoever it was going to be on commentary with him, Vince. He had it with JR and pretty much just JR. You look at Bobby Heenan, he had it with JR. He had it with Tony Schiavone, as you say. He had it with Vince. He had it with Gorilla Monsoon. He had it with Mean Gene Okerlund. It didn't matter who he sat next to. He was going to be able to find a way to play off them, make them into a babyface, even if they weren't particularly trying to be a character, and make himself into a hugely entertaining comic heel. He's one of the first real comic heels, because he could be very intense and very cutting and very savage, but he could also be hilarious. You know, the quotes have been doing the rounds and all the tributes from the WWE in recent sort of days, and they'll be going on for days and weeks to come. He was also a very, very good heel wrestler. People forget about that in the early parts of his career. It's a far less iconic part of his career than the subsequent managerial days. But he was kind of that great cowardly heel wrestler. There's tag matches where he'll tag in, punch someone. As soon as they turn around to punch him, he'll tag back out and hide. Just great comedy stuff like that. And it's almost, you can almost liken it, you know, you can almost see a little bit of Eddie Guerrero in what he's doing, or a little bit of heel Chris Jericho in what he's doing, which is just so entertaining. And when you think that you've mentioned there three of the greatest of all time in their fields, you know, Eddie Guerrero, Paul Heyman, Jerry the King Lawler, Bobby the Brain Heenan was the inspiration to all of them. He was all of them in one. An entertaining comedy heel wrestler, an entertaining comedy heel savage cutting manager, an entertaining comedy heel savage cutting commentator. He literally had it all. He was the complete package, and the tributes that have poured in a testament to that. He was the greatest at whatever he turned his hand to within the business. Whatever he decided he was going to do within the industry, he was going to do it better than anyone else. And I always think of Bobby Heenan in a lot of ways as being kind of Vince's Ric Flair during the 80s, because Ric Flair was still on the, you know, the territorial circuit, still working with the NWA stuff, still working with the AWA, and a lot of the territories across the states, making himself into a national star by working the territories. Bobby Heenan was in the WWF on national programming, and he was coming out in the glitzy suits, you know, looking phenomenal, having that great look, having a great haircut, being hugely entertaining, being hugely extravagant, being extremely funny when he needed to be. And it was kind of this dichotomy. He was filling the Ric Flair role for Vince before Ric Flair came to do that himself. And if I can sort of, I guess, close with my favourite Bobby Heenan quote, and it actually doesn't come from his time working in the industry. It actually comes, I saw it on social media a couple of days ago, and it was from a fan interaction in just the last couple of years. And one of the real testaments to Bobby Heenan as a man and as a person is the fact that even as he was ravaged by cancer, he'd lost a huge amount of his bottom jaw to this disease. He was withered, he was shrunken, he was small, he looked older than his years. He must have been exhausted with all the various medical treatments. He was still going out to sign autographs for his fans, to do meet and greets, to do talks. And a fan said to him, as he's getting a signature, "This is the best moment of my life." And Bobby Heenan turned to him and said, "Come on, boy, didn't you ever come?" Which is just an incredible, incredible response. I loved Bobby the Brain Heenan, and I still do. And his memories will last, his legacy will last a very long time as he continues to influence and inspire current and future wrestlers for generations to come. And his place in history shouldn't be forgotten, because I do feel he's one of the more underrated personalities in WWE history. So I echo your sentiments in terms of our best wishes, our condolences, but also the great memories that Bobby the Brain Heenan offered. So much love to Bobby Heenan, much love to his family and friends, those closest to him, those who worked with him. And yeah, what a magical and incredible human being he was.
I could not echo that sentiment any better. Beautifully said. And a fitting tribute to one of the greatest of all time. Rest in peace, Bobby the Brain Heenan. So we don't segue from such tragedy and yet such glorious remembrance of a career. So let's simply get into our other topic, which you guys voted for, which is the 2001 Royal Rumble match. It is my favorite Royal Rumble match of all time, and I'm pretty sure it is Steve's second after 2000, if I'm correct. Is that a fair estimation?
As a Royal Rumble match, 2001 is my favorite, without doubt.
Oh, wow.
Incredible.
Oh, I think, was it 2000 as an overall Royal Rumble is
Yeah, 2000 favorite. As an overall pay-per-view would be my favorite, but 2001 as a match is just, it's just so good.
Yes, it is. So it's just, this is a great topic because we can take it anywhere we like and we can just talk about it. So do you know what? I led for Bobby. I shall let you lead with the 2001 Royal Rumble match, sir.
Well, this Royal Rumble match encompassed absolutely everything that was the Attitude Era. It was probably, I guess, maybe the last Royal Rumble of the Attitude Era in 2001 because it was the pre-invasion Royal Rumble. And it's like they just went, it's almost like Vince knew what was going to happen. And maybe at this point he did, he probably did. The negotiations must have been well underway at this point to purchase WCW. So it was almost like he knew what was going to happen. And it was this one last blowout. So the Attitude Era had been a bit more violent, a bit more hardcore, a bit more extreme in what it was doing. So this became the Hardcore Rumble, and that's the legacy, I guess, of this Royal Rumble match, where you have people like Raven coming in and Al Snow and all these guys from the Hardcore title picture, and they're bringing trash cans and kendo sticks and signposts down to the ring to start battering each other in the skull with. They're sliding out under the bottom rope and using that. They're actually using the rules of you're only eliminated if you go over the top rope. No one said anything. If I go under the bottom rope, I can just voluntarily get out, go under the ring apron, get a fire extinguisher, smash someone in the face with it, let it off into someone's face, you know, get out a steel chair, roll back in the ring, hit people a few times. It was just genius. It was just brilliant. It had celebrity cameos showing kind of where WWE was. So Drew Carey came down. I think the Hardy Boys end up eliminating each other and Drew Carey's kind of left standing in the ring like, "Yeah, I showed you." And then down comes Kane, and it's like, oh, shit. And Drew Carey eliminates himself. They have the returning legend, someone like the Honky Tonk Man coming down, which is probably my highlight of the entire match. Coming down, he starts singing his theme tune while Kane's just standing in the ring with that classic tilted head expression and stance that he had, which you knew shit was going to go down. He's just standing there like, what the fuck is this? The same way that he looked at Pete Rose at WrestleMania 14 before tombstoning him twice. You knew that something was going to go down. He just snatches the guitar out of the Honky Tonk Man's hands and just busts it over his head. Like, that did not happen in the 80s to the greatest intercontinental champion of all time. Bar the Miz, obviously. So it was just, there was just so many great memories and great moments. Obviously, Austin winning it, Kane being the MVP of the Royal Rumble. And it was, as ridiculous as it is to say, considering Kane was already a world champion, considering the impact of his debut in the Hell in a Cell match of Undertaker and Shawn Michaels a few years previously, it almost felt like the moment where Kane really arrived. This was true prime, monstrous, bestial Kane. It's probably that era, late 2000 and kind of through to the middle of 2001, is maybe my favourite period of Kane, of his career. It was, he was absolutely jacked. His kind of the cut off at the shoulder vest rather than the one sleeve ensemble that he had previously, the mask, it looked fantastic. The whole kind of outfit was the best it ever looked. And this was the Royal Rumble of Kane. It was the Royal Rumble of hardcore. It was the Royal Rumble, of course, that Stone Cold wins, the comeback win. And his, what was that, his third Royal Rumble win, his final Royal Rumble win, indeed. Setting up, of course, the incredible WrestleMania 17 a couple of months later with The Rock. You had, I think the final four was The Rock, Kane, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and the one Billy Gunn, which is just amazing. Because they were legitimately going to push Billy Gunn. This was kind of a tester to see whether he belonged in this crowd. And they wanted to push Billy Gunn possibly to being a world champion. Really good looking, popular, good on the mic, entertaining, decent, solid in the ring. Good worker, been around a long time. They considered putting him in the title picture, making him a main eventer. And this was kind of a tester for it. And it was like, they're all looking at him like, yeah, you don't belong here, Mr. Ass. Get the fuck out. But it was the whole thing, it was a spectacle. And it was probably the best spectacle Royal Rumble for me that there has ever been, because it just contained everything that we adored and loved about that era of wrestling and WWF in particular. And the fact that Kane came out as the real MVP of that Rumble, who was one of my favorite guys at the time, it was a huge mark for Kane, was just so exciting for me. I was so frustrated in a lot of ways when he went out. I really wanted him to win because he deserved it the entire way through the match. It's just incredible. And if people haven't watched that Royal Rumble match, but they do love a Rumble, and we all love a Rumble, let's be honest. We know it's not going to be good wrestling for the most part, but we know it's going to be, you know, exciting and fun and entertaining. This is the absolute pinnacle of that. It's truly incredible. I mean, it could be the match of any week, the Royal Rumble 2001 match. It's absolutely sublime.
Wow, it's really hard to kind of follow that up. You kind of covered all bases beautifully. What I find so enjoyable about this match is the hardcore element. The hardcore rumble, as a lot of people have actually coined it over the years. It's so cool to see something different in the rumble. Because before that, the only other time I'd seen hardcore interaction in a rumble before this was 1998, when it opened up with Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie, and they just went to fucking
shit out of each other.
Yeah, it was just ridiculous. It was like, oh, okay, we're not going to have the Royal Rumble match. We'll just have a Texas Death match instead. Phenomenal stuff. And like you mentioned, I guess I'm just going to kind of elaborate on some of the things you mentioned. This is Kane's Rumble. At the time, the record eliminations. And it's the presence. It's the aura about him. But not only that, this was the first time I got to see Kane work numerous styles. He had the interaction with Austin near the end. You know, the fact that he was this main event level monster. He could hang with the best of them. He had the interaction with The Rock in the middle. The Rock comes out at number 13, which is so cool, because there is no way someone of the level of The Rock now would ever come out at number 13. But back then, it truly had that magic of being random and completely of the unknown. We knew Rikishi was number 30. The rest of it was all up to chance. And two of the greatest memories for me of this Rumble are Kane going absolutely radio rental with a dustbin and just annihilating the entire mid card. he just goes mad. And like, even JR's like, my God, he's like going crazy. And like, Kane's just swatting Perry Saturn over the top rope, Raven over the top rope. Al Snow, get out, just freaking out. And as the last man is hauled out, all of a sudden you hear, oh, he's just a honky-tonk man. He's a honky-tonk man. And he comes rolling out. And you're like, this is everything that the Attitude Era encompassed. This pure, destructive, incredible character, this monster of a man, followed by an Elvis tribute. Come on! This is wrestling at the absolute pinnacle of entertainment. And then he levels him, like you said, with a guitar. He throws him out. And then the Rock's music hits. It's like, have it, have it, have it, have it. You will have all the entertainment you can handle from the get-go to the end. That's why the Attitude Era, to people like us, is so special and so memorable. Not because it was the best quality, but because you got the absolute best every single time. Every moment you turned your head in an Attitude Era, Royal Rumble especially, but any kind of Attitude Era content, there was always a level of excitement. The product grabbed you. You didn't have to grab the hold of the product and find the things you loved back then. Nowadays, I switch it on and I think, well, I love The Miz, so I can tolerate this stuff. And I love this guy and I watch this, and the other stuff is just filler to me. Back then, the product grabbed me by the throat. Pay attention, you young whippersnapper. I'm going to fucking show you how it's done. And this was the epitome of it. The epicenter of entertainment. This matches everything you want. For me, the most star-studded Rumble as well. People say later on in times, you know, I think the 2005 Royal Rumble, people are like, oh, star-studded Royal Rumble, Batista, John Cena, get the fuck out of here. The 2001 Royal Rumble had Stone Cold Steve Austin, it had Kane, it had The Undertaker, it had even, what makes me laugh is even he or Rikishi at that time was a star. It had The Rock, it had the Hardy Boys. All of these people had APA. Even the jobbers, the mid-carders, people of the likes of Raven, an ECW legend, you know, Perry Saturn. And the other real moment that I remember as well is the electricity. So Kane and The Undertaker are teaming up. They're throwing everybody out. They're just completely unstoppable. What a force. The image of these two brothers standing side by side. And then Scotty Too Hotty's music hits. And he's like banging it. And you see a man with a large amount of shit training down the back of his legs sauntering to the ring. And the iconic line as he jumps in the ring from JR of, it's like two carnivores fighting over a chicken leg. It's utterly hysterical. And then, of course, Scotty Too Hotty's out and they're like, do you know what? Who's fucking next? And you hear the glass shatter and the fucking place explodes. It goes crazy. And Austin comes there. He gets jumped by Triple H. You've got storylines going on outside the ring. You've got the Big Show returning. You've got all of this and more. And this was what the Attitude Era gave you. Everything it had at its disposal, because there was no fucking around. And this was at a point where we knew WCW and ECW were essentially dying. They were so close to going out of business. Only, 2 months later would they go out of business. But even then, they were like, no. We are going to put our fucking hammer down here. And we are going to set an example for what is maximum entertainment. Drew Carey nowadays, get the fuck out of here. Drew Carey, 2001 Royal Rumble, funny as fuck. Kane comes down, threatens to choke Sam, and he's saved by Raven. He jumps over the top rope. Brilliant. They did everything so brilliantly. And for me, this is the epitome of what the Attitude Era is all about. And it's punctuated by the fact that this Royal Rumble, as an overall event, sold 625,000 buys on pay-per-view. 625,000 buys. Now, people are saying, oh, that's not doesn't sound like a big amount. Bearing in mind that when WWE was running pay-per-views essentially through 2010 until they came to the network era, they were averaging 80,000 to 120,000. maximum. That includes things like WrestleMania. 625,000 buys for a Royal Rumble. The crowd is hot as hell. The undercard's incredible. I urge people to watch the entire event. The undercard's got some very special stuff, including what is arguably the greatest singles ladder match of all time between Chris Benoit and Chris Jericho for the Intercontinental title. But for me, it's all about this match. And you voted well to pick this one out. This is a special match. Go to the WWE Network. Go and watch the 2001 Royal Rumble. Then you'll understand why people love the Attitude Era so much. Frankly, if you don't like it, there's no saving you.
Absolutely not. You are damned. You are damned. So,
damned, I guess, for all eternity.
Oh, yeah. So I guess we should move on to our mid-carders of the week. And as is customary, I shall break the ice. I shall go first. Mine, I guess, is reasonably contentious to an extent. I have gone with my mid-carder of the week as Dude Love. Now,
ooh.
I know... Now, I know Mick Foley has obviously won the world title as Mankind, as previously discussed in Match of the Week past, but Dude Love only ever won the tag titles, and I think only for one night. You won it with Stone Cold, didn't he? And then he got stripped from it the following night on Raw.
Yes.
Dude Love was the antithesis of everything that we had seen from Mick Foley up to this point in his entire career. So we'd always seen Mick Foley's characters, Cactus Jack and Mankind, and they are obviously both kind of unhinged maniacs or broken down psychopaths. And Dude Love was this fun loving, ready to embrace life. You know, this was Mick Foley living his childhood dream quite literally. This was Mick Foley's homage to Shawn Michaels, you know, one of his favorite wrestlers of all time. Even growing up, he loved Shawn Michaels. You know, as like a young guy getting into the business, he just adored Shawn Michaels. He was everything that Mick Foley wasn't. Handsome, good-looking, muscular, defined, cool, sexy. And Dude Love was, you know, well, Mick Foley was this kind of chubby, wild-looking, matted, long hair and beard, violent, pain-loving, usually bleeding psychopath, pulling out chunks of his own hair and rocking in the corner screaming. And Dude Love was completely different. Dude Love was trying to be cool. Dude Love was trying to be sexy in this really corny and cheesy and camp way. He was just brilliant to watch. He was so much fun. And he's the most underused and underrated of the faces of Foley. And what Dude Love did was lay the foundation and lay the groundwork for some of the most legendary and iconic Foley moments in future years. We suddenly were open to the idea of a funny and entertaining and softer Mankind who came after Dude Love. The untucked white shirt, Mr. Socko, Yerpal the Clown, This Is Your Life, and all that stuff was made possible because the fans had already seen and bought into the Dude Love character. The Commissioner Mick Foley that we've come to see and know and love, kind of the real person, I guess, of Mick Foley that we've been able to see on WWE programming in later years, particularly as the Commissioner, someone who was funny and was telling cheesy, stupid jokes and getting cheap pops. That, again, was born from the Dude Love character. The Dude Love was the closest thing to Mick Foley and to, I guess, teenage Mick Foley that we'd ever seen in his career, which was already, 15 to 20 years old by the time that Dude Love actually made his debut in the late 90s. He did get, of course, memorably one title shot for the WWF title against the champ Stone Cold Steve Austin during the height of the Austin-McMahon rivalry. And this was with Dude Love had kind of turned heel, basically, because Vince McMahon had said, you go out there as Mick Foley, just after he decided he didn't want to be Cactus Jack anymore, because as Cactus Jack, He'd laid there and he'd bled and he'd been ridiculously hardcore, and all the fans had done was chant for Austin while he laid there in pain. It was a great promo. He came out and wrestled as Mick Foley, just Mick Foley, for the first time in his career against Chainsaw Charlie, Terry Funk. And if he wins, he stays in the company, he wins. And Mick Foley offers him the chance, Vince McMahon offers Mick the chance to once again reclaim the Dude Love character if he turns his back on someone who really had been his friend up to that point, of course, a former tag team partner, Stone Cold Steve Austin. He becomes the corporate dude, where suddenly he's got these sexy groupies rather than just kind of these quite demurely dressed groupies, much more attitude era groupies in far less clothing, gyrating themselves all over Mick Foley. Very bizarre to watch, very creepy. And they have a really, really good match. And if people want to watch how, if you're going to transition between different characters, how to change your wrestling style as part of that, something we've criticized Finn Balor when he becomes the demon for not doing well enough, go and watch Dude Love versus Stone Cold Steve Austin at Over the Edge 98. Really, really good title match. And even though he is a heel Dude Love up against Stone Cold, he still wrestles in a very different way from anything that we'd seen from Mankind or Cactus Jack. And even to an extent, the face Dude Love previously. So really, really, really good match. Really great psychology. The things going on around it because of Mr. McMahon and the corporation and all that stuff. Really good watch. So my mid-carder of the week, because he only ever won one tag team title in his run in the WWF, is Dude Love, one of the faces of Foley.
Wow, I went for something entirely different in terms of the mid-carder of the week. That's a fantastic choice because it's not only contentious, but it's also quite a swerve. It's quite cool that, do you know what? It's essentially a testament to how good Mick Foley was, that his characters, the schizophrenic characters, were so believable as their individual entities that you could pick Dude Love as a mid-carder. It's not really contentious, actually. I think he is essentially a mid-card. He had some great runs. His tag team title run with Austin was so cool. So different, so unique, so refreshing at a time where they were struggling to create interesting characters. My mid-carder of the week is someone of absolutely no notoriety whatsoever, especially in comparison to Dude Love. My mid-carder of the week is simply known as Tom Brandy. And this is going to be a real head scratcher for a lot of people, because a lot of people won't even know who the fuck that is. And nor should they, really. But the reason I remember him, we were talking about the Royal Rumble, of course, 2001. Now, in the 1998 Royal Rumble, I vaguely remember the man in Italian trunks coming down and being eliminated in about 12 seconds by Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie. And I thought, how obscure can I get my mid-carder to be? And this guy is as obscure as they come. Unsurprisingly, Tom Brandy, from the East Coast of America, essentially, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Tom Brandy is also known as Salvatore Sincere and Johnny Gunn. Billed from Italy, unsurprisingly, as Salvatore Sincere. So his career is remarkably uninteresting in so many ways. Debuted in 1985. He was trained by the indie wrestler King Kaluha, which tells you everything you need to know about his carny reputation. His first notoriety came in International World-Class Championship Wrestling. He won the television title as a Chippendale. That was it. Like, it's just, this is one of those guys. I mean, I actually felt that this was quite contentious because he's not really even a mid-carder. He is the jobber to end all jobbers in a lot of ways. Jobber of the week. Let us know if you want a jobber of the week too. He did actually join ECW for a small time and teamed with Tommy Dreamer and won the ECW Tag Team Championships. He was a tag team champion with Tommy Dreamer in ECW. And that's the cool thing about guys like this, is you find weird stuff about this. Was in 1994 when Tommy Dreamer was still, you know, the baby face guy in the trunks. He hadn't transitioned to, you know, can I have another one, please, sir? And all this hardcore shit. He was just simply known as Dreamer, you know, the baby face tard that nobody gave a shit about. And here he is tagging with unknown Tom Brandy and becoming an ECW champion. They captured the titles from Johnny Hotbody and Tony Stetson in only 9 seconds. They would then lose the titles, and this will give you a great pleasure, to Kevin Sullivan and the Tasmaniac Taz.
Beautiful.
That's the crossover appeal here is actually quite wonderful. His only real heavyweight title that he won that really meant anything, he won the United States Wrestling Federation Championship under the name Johnny Gunn, which I mentioned earlier. After losing the championship to his former trainer, King Kaluha, he actually won the tag team championships with King Kaluha against Damage Incorporated, which is actually quite a renowned name on that independent circuit from the time. His WWF run was utterly pointless in so many ways. He was there from 96 to 98. He debuted as Salvatore Sincere, the villainous stereotypical Italian guy. He had pink and white and would falsely claim be sincere and everyone.
I remember this.
It is... He was at the 1996 Survivor Series and In Your House, It's Time, where he wrestled in dark matches. So he didn't even get on the main card. And of course, dark matches back then were not televised. It wasn't like we had a Mountain Dew pre-show. Although, frankly, Tom Brady isn't even worthy of the Mountain Dew pre-show. I'm so sorry if Tom Brady ever listens to this. He's probably going to be, fuck off, I tried my hardest. His entire run was just punctuated by that kind of mentality. However, he did get to work some matches with people like Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. Obviously, he was annihilated, but reality is, if you're at that level, that's still the pinnacle of your career. And let's be honest, how many people can say they've got in the ring with a Shawn Michaels or an Undertaker, you know, and worked a match with them? It's still an achievement, even if it is, you know, a very little achievement just to job out to these guys. But like I say, I mentioned the 1998 Royal Rumble match. That's what he's most famous for. He was in there for a few seconds. He was eliminated by Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie. He left the WWF April of that year, unsurprisingly. He lost to Jeff Jarrett in his last ever televised match on a episode of Monday Night Raw in March 1998. That was it for him, really. He went to the independent circuit again, which, believe it or not, he is still wrestling in to this current day.
Wow.
He is 51 years old. Which, considering that era of wrestlers, not heinously old, really. I don't know, maybe I just expected him to be older, but he's 51 years old. Since leaving the WWF, he's wrestled in the independent circuit under, obviously, Tom Brandy and the Sincere names. He also sometimes wrestles and does autograph signings under a mask as the Patriot, despite not having the permission of the original Patriot, Dale Wilkes. Which is very strange to me. So he just tips up at these events and he's like, I'm the Patriot. No, you're not. Yes, I am. Fuck you. He just doesn't even... It's so, so strange. So, yeah, I mean, that kind of punctuates him. But my mid-carder of the week is Tom Brandy.
Beautiful. Very obscure, mate. Good effort. So should we do a match of the week to close out the show?
Oh, yes.
Okay, I shall go first. Now, you and I are obviously marked for some strong style British wrestling. It's something that obviously at the moment is having a bit of a resurgence with the likes of Neville and Jack Gallagher, Tyler Bate, all these guys getting into the WWE, getting onto 205 Live and NXT, etc. So, I thought I would go back to the pinnacle of popularity for British wrestling in the mainstream. And that would be World of Wrestling on ITV back in 1981. Oh, yes. And I'm going for a match which is Big Daddy versus Giant Haystacks in 1981 at Wembley Arena. Now, if you're hoping for some kind of technical WrestleFest or Flippy-Do match to be watching via Facebook in the coming days, you will be sorely disappointed. However, this was so... It still is so iconic to British wrestling fans because the popularity of this show was insane. This show had around about 17 million viewers in 1981. Of a population of the UK at the time was 50 million. 56 million, I think. That's a third. A third of the population of the United Kingdom tuned in to watch this match live from Wembley Arena. This was, and it was a match that they'd seen before. This wasn't the first time they'd met. They'd actually used to be tag team partners, heel tag team, crushing everyone, basically. And then they just, they, you know, did the classic heel turn. Giant Haystacks stays a heel, Big Daddy becomes a face, and he comes out dressed, you know, very much in something that maybe we'd expect John Cena to do nowadays in terms of, he came out in full, like, Union Jack regalia with, like, a Union Jack hat and cape and boots and stupid shit like that. Coming down to the ring. And actually, to, you know, in terms of the popularity of this at the time, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Queen Elizabeth II both publicly stated that they were fans of Big Daddy. Can you imagine that happening now? Can you imagine the Queen coming out, "Oh, I do love Neville"? Shut your mouth, Liz. It just would not happen. And the reality is that this rivalry and both of these competitors are still talked about today. And we're, you know, what, 36 years on? It is still talked about today in the UK by an older generation who would never classify themselves as wrestling fans. They would never dream of watching the WWE now. They just wouldn't. Because it's, you know, it's overproduced, it's ridiculous, it's camp, it's not proper men, it's not proper wrestling. They just wouldn't watch it. This was sort of their pinnacle of the business. And this match really is a moment in British wrestling history that put British wrestling on the map. And to kind of, I guess, illustrate that, Giant Haystacks actually wrestled for Stu Hart's Stampede in the 80s before it kind of got swallowed up by the WWF and Vince McMahon. He was a two-time tag champion there under the name of the Loch Ness Monster. The first time was with the Dynamite Kid. The second time was with the little-known Bret Hart as his partner. He actually, in the mid-90s, Haystacks went to WCW. Yes, in 1996, and he was just called Loch Ness at this point, and he feuded with Hulk Hogan. And during that period, he actually was diagnosed with cancer, and so he retired and came back to the UK. It's just incredible to think that this launched such an incredible career. Unfortunately, John Haystacks is, in fact, neither of them are with us any longer. And I guess one of the more unfortunate memories of Big Daddy's career, real name Shirley Crabtree, was that he had the misfortune to be wrestling an opponent called King Kong Kirk. And he delivered his finisher, which was a standing splash, very Mark Henry or Viscera for WWF fans. And unfortunately, King Kong Kirk, it turned out, had an underlying heart condition. And after the splash literally immediately caused him to have a heart attack, and he was whisked off to hospital where he died. And it obviously wasn't the fault of Big Daddy. It was nothing to do with, he didn't do anything wrong. There was no botch involved or anything like that. This guy had an undiagnosed heart condition. It's one of those things that can happen, particularly when you look at the size of the wrestlers that were wrestling on, you know, the world of sports stuff. At that time, they were all huge. They were all fat. Basically, they were all morbidly obese. So, you know, for one of them to have a heart condition really isn't out of the question, especially if it's go undiagnosed as well back in the 1980s, really wasn't out of the question either. So this match was all about storyline. It was all about a real good guy versus a real bad guy. Real traditional British panto in a lot of ways. But an iconic moment nonetheless in British wrestling history, and undoubtedly something that has inspired the legions of great British wrestlers that have come since, particularly, I would say, considering, you know, his age and his generation. Someone like William Regal, who would have been watching this as a young wrestler at the time, and seeing the popularity and seeing how rabidly everyone was into this, would really have been inspired to kick on his own career and think of the heights that he reached and how he in turn has inspired the real invasion of British wrestlers that we're seeing at the moment on the indie scene all around the world. You know, the likes of Marty Scurll and Pete Dunne and all these guys. So I have to have my match of the week from June the 20th, 1981, Giant Haystacks versus Big Daddy.
Amazing. It also has quite a personal connection to me. My grandfather, who I never, unfortunately, had the opportunity of meeting, he passed away just a matter of months, actually, before I was born, was actually a reasonable friend of both men and British wrestlers at the British wrestling circuit. My mum detests wrestling, but whenever she speaks of her dad, she speaks of his love for British wrestling, and that's where she reckons I get my love for wrestling. And when I used to do, shall we say, cheap developmental shows and things like that, when I got a chance to wrestle in front of small school crowds and stuff like that, I always had my grandfather's name on the back of my leg. Even in front of, you know, small amounts of school children at these school halls and things like that, it was always such an immense honour for me to know that my grandfather was such a lover of British wrestling. And so for that reason, on top of everything else that comes with being such a huge British indie wrestling fan and a fan of British wrestling, full stop, the world of wrestling, the world of sport era, that's a fantastic pick in my book. Well done, sir.
Oh, yes.
My pick, unfortunately, is not so fantastic. I've been relatively serious for a couple of weeks, so it is now time to regale you with something very special. So you may cast your minds back to WrestleMania 6, and the main event of WrestleMania 6 was the iconic clash between Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. Ha-ha! Now, some of you are saying, that's, to be fair, iconic. How can you really have that as a joke, you know, match of the week? Well, very simple. You see, that was iconic, albeit actually quite a poor match of itself, but it told a great story. So WCW likes to do things again. It likes to revisit history. And in 1998, at WCW's Halloween Havoc, we got the rematch to end all rematches. Hollywood Hulk Hogan versus Warrior. This is a steaming pile of shit that is unrecognizable from anything else I have ever seen. This match has the absolute gall to be 14 minutes long. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, it is 14 minutes of your life you will never get back, which is why I'm going to be an arsehole and make you watch it on our Facebook page. It is, without a shadow of a doubt, the worst and most tragically executed wrestling match WCW ever had. This is a company that, as we've explained before, had Viagra on a pole, boxes on a pole, Judy Bagwell on a forklift. No. Just no. This is horrific. We had Hollywood Hulk Hogan at a point in his career where, frankly, the crowd didn't give two fucks. Yeah, you're in the NWO. Whoop-de-doo, mate. Even by this point, the NWO was kind of like, man, nobody really gives a shit. Warrior was a tragic, unbelievable, and pathetic shell of himself, his former self. And not only that, he was such a unlikable hero. Everybody knew what he had done by this point, really. You know, it was out there. He had changed his name to Warrior, for the love of Christ. And this match is punctuated by two highly amusing moments for me. They are two iconic moments. Now, you might have seen the fireball being thrown back in the day in wrestling. Very rare, mostly in Japan, actually, unsurprisingly. And it was done with usually great effect. Now, Hulk Hogan frantically, the concept is that you essentially have a special kind of paper slash powder stuff. It's a substance, and you can essentially set it alight for a moment, and it gives the impression that you're throwing a fireball. So it's like a flare-up very quickly, very much in the way lighter fluid might do it. A small amount of lighter fluid, it will burn for a moment, and then it will disappear. So you can create this illusion that you are throwing fire in a man's face. This is all very well and good. Unfortunately, Hulk Hogan is not very adept with a lighter. And what happens is he manages to set it alight and then throws it after it has dissipated because he hasn't set it alight properly, at which point Warrior is forced to pretend that he's been hit with fire that fizzled out beforehand. So we get this hysterical, if not unrelentingly painful moment where he sells air and to great effect. This alone is enough to punctuate what this match is all about. Unfortunately, Eric Bischoff holds the referee. Well, I say unfortunately. Fortunately, for anybody who was in the crowd, Eric Bischoff holds the referee after 14 minutes of what is the most botch-filled, miserable, pathetic excuse for a wrestling match. He holds the referee, and Hulk Hogan gives what can only be described as a Lance Storm-esque ECW barely legal chair shot to Warrior and pins him. It is horrific. I cannot explain to you what this match is. This match is like watching two elderly men in a care home fumbling around on the floor for their contacts and every now and then tripping over each other. This match is the equivalent of two dying yaks ferociously having an epileptic fit in a field as they fitter out their last dying moments.
Yak
this match
attack
is frankly a steaming miscarriage of justice. It is unacceptable in any form or era. This match makes Gobbledygooker an acceptable character. Congratulations, gentlemen. You took one of the most iconic moments in wrestling history and made it an even bigger farce than Donald Trump's presidency. You are a fucking pair of idiots, and you deserve to be regarded as such for this moment alone. And yes, I appreciate Warrior has passed on, but that will never excuse this disgusting moment, this 40 minutes of unnecessary behavior. So my match of the week is the rematch between Hollywood Hulk Hogan and the Warrior at WCW's Halloween Havoc 1998. Enjoy that.
God, Halloween Havoc produced some absolute shit. It really did produce some bad matches. And this is up there with the worst of them. This is almost like one of the best matches to sum up WCW and why they went wrong. It's like, what should we do? Let's get some really old men that did great stuff 15 years ago and make them try and do it again with no legs, no spine. It's just fucking amazing. Great choice, great selection, because it is literally one of the worst matches of all time for all the wrong. It's not even the one of those where it's so bad it's good, you know, like a kennel from hell. It's just utter shit.
I would rather watch 14 minutes of Kennel from Hell dogs ferociously yes, humping and eating their own feces than ever have to tolerate such a miserable excuse for wrestling as this match was.
Absolutely beautiful. Well, that is a great high point. But So I don't need to repeat all the plugs. They'll be available in the description as ever for social media sites and, of course, our friends as well. People like Taylor Talks, Mike's Open Journal, Global Canvas Club, all those usual suspects. So I guess it's down to Amir to close us out and take us home, baby.
Yes, it is. Our one point, as always, at the Smart Plug, where you can get at the polls to vote for what we will be discussing every week on Manic Mondays. The polls are usually put up of a Sunday or a Monday and will conclude on a Thursday, which is normally when we record. So during that time period, please go to that Twitter account and check out the polls there. And of course, you can check out all our other content via the Facebook page, via the social media links, as Steve has mentioned. of course, look out for our usual suspects, our pair of Week in Universe podcasts, and of course, any Indy 50 stuff going forward, should that float your boat indeed. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much once again for listening to our nostalgic look back into wrestling that is Manic Mondays. Thank you very much to Steve Neal, as always.
Thanks for having me, mate. It's been a good show again this week.
It has been my pleasure entirely. Thank you very much, sir. I have been your host, Amir Ozzaneni. He has been Stephen Neal. And we will catch you very soon for another podcast from the Smart Plug Network.
Well, folks, we're all out of time. This is Johnny Gomez saying good fight, good night.